This talk is one of hundreds of hours of leading Christian thinking. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org and sign up to get our monthly email. More resources to support ministry are available to you now. The European Leadership Forum exists to connect local Christian leaders with God's global resources.
If you don't mind, I'm just going to start again for the record. That this is the seminar on leading people effectively and managing people effectively. As I was saying, there are various views about what constitutes managing and what constitutes leading. John Cotter, a leading expert at the Harvard Business School, says that managing is the process of managing complexity, of bringing order out of complexity. And leading, he says, is the process of dealing with change. Both of those things are needed in any organization, I think. So whether you call it leading or managing, that's what I'm going to try to be talking about how to deal with complexity in organizations, how to deal with change, and in particular, how to do that through people. So without more ado, let's ask you, think about it for a minute. Think about yourself and your own style. What is your preferred leadership style? Think to yourself which of these it might be while I just go and push that door to. Most of us find that we have a kind of style that was comfortable for us, that we just kind of fall into day after day. We may think that some different styles are better or more appropriate, and the management gurus will all tell us what it is that we ought to be doing. But we tend to fall back on our own style, our natural style, time and time again. It may be supporting. It's a nice kind of encouraging, sounds a Christian type of style. Delegating sounds like a good management technique. Guiding, again, probably a nice Christian style. And directing doesn't sound terribly Christian. It sounds like giving people commands. So we tend to fight shy of thinking that we direct people. We tend to think that what I ought to be doing is supporting, guiding, and delegating. But one way or another, we tend to settle on one of them because it just happens to be more natural to us. Well, I want to suggest to you that real leadership is not what we could call comfort zone leadership. It's not actually doing what we most feel comfortable with. It's not the thing that we most like doing, but it's what we need to do in order to give what I'll call employees, people who work for us or with us, the leadership that they actually need. Not what we want, but what they need. And if we do that, if we focus on the employees and what they need, then we'll find that the style that we use, whether it's supporting or guiding or directing or delegating, that we will try to give to them the style that they most need at the time. And that's really what this seminar is going to be about. Welcome. We've only just started. So, in a nutshell, what we're going to be talking about today is to try to identify what's the real need of the people who work with us, and how do we make sure that we give them the kind of leadership, the kind of management style that they most need. And that's an approach which we call situational leadership. Let's start out by thinking about what I'm going to call the employee. Forgive the term, it's very difficult to know what to call the person. It might be a volunteer. It might be somebody who's employed by your organization. It might be a church member or something like that. But for the sake of ease of reference, I'm going to talk about employees, somebody who works with us, who works for the organization in some way. So start off with thinking about the employee. And I also want to say we're thinking about that person's readiness for a specific task. We often tend to characterize people as being generally good or generally poor at what they do. But actually, what they do or what they're expected to do will probably fall into a number of different tasks. Any given day will bring a number of different tasks. And the question for us is, to what extent is this person ready for this specific task? And we'll be looking at that in some detail in a moment. If you think about different things that people are called upon to do, let's suppose that you had a person who was in your organization who was perhaps a welcomer at your church, somebody who welcomes people as they arrive. And they've been shown how to do it, they've been given some training, they've been encouraged to do it, they've been encouraged to smile and shake hands with people and give them a book or whatever it is that you do at the door of your church. And then you say, right, that person, after about 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks, that person is getting pretty good at it now. They're getting better and better. People feel welcomed when they come in. That's good. That's what we wanted. Now, that person is good. They've developed skill at the job. They really want to do it. And so why don't we now need a leader for the welcome team for our evening services. Why don't we ask this person to become the leader of our welcome team? Well, that may be a good idea, but we have just changed their task. They've moved from being a welcomer to being a team leader. Different task. So whereas they were probably very good at being a welcomer, they may not be very good at being a team leader. We don't know. They could become very good. Whatever, they are starting from zero virtually again because it's a whole new task. And that's what I mean by task specific. Readiness means they're ready to take the job. They're prepared for the job, if you like, in a number of different ways. So the two ways that I want to look at it are, first of all, skill or ability. And you'll see there, if you're working with the notes, you're welcome to work with the notes or not as you choose. But we have at least four areas that we would think about in order to determine somebody's skill at a job. In the first place, their aptitude for it. People have aptitudes for certain things and not for others. I tend to have no aptitude whatsoever for drawing things, for pictures and images. I would never get picked for a job that required me to draw things. My wife does all the painting and decorating and wallpaper hanging in our home because I can't hold something straight for the life of me. On the other hand, I guess my aptitude is probably with the written word. That's what I would tend to do. So in our family, we kind of divide things up that way. So aptitude is a good indicator, first of all, of skill. Secondly, obviously, education. How well has somebody been trained to do a job? Or what's their educational background? If you wanted somebody perhaps to be a financial analyst in your organization, you probably wouldn't start with somebody who'd never taken arithmetic at school or mathematics. You'd probably like somebody who was reasonably comfortable with working with numbers. So aptitude and education, two key elements of skill or ability. Training. What's the difference between training and education? No?
Education is formal and training is whatever.
Yeah, formal and informal. Yeah. Yeah. I suppose education probably is a fairly long, drawn-out process, goes for some considerable time, whereas a training course can be something fairly short-term. There's a difference as to specificity as well, isn't there? Education tends to be fairly broad. Training tends to be fairly specific. We train somebody to be a teacher or a leader with a fairly with training courses that help them to understand that. Whereas education perhaps is forming the whole person. So training, have they got some kind of specific training? And of course experience. Have they done this before? Those four elements probably tell us most of the things we need to know about a person's ability, skill to do a job. But as well as skill, we have to try to think about somebody's, what I've called will here, or motivation. How strongly motivated are they to do this task? Well, I've given you there are some elements of what perhaps constitutes will or motivation. Let's think about drive. I think about people who are driven. They feel driven to do something. Think about your job, what it is that you do. How strong is your drive to do it? Of course, you sometimes get tired of doing it. And then in that case, your drive might well go down, which is why we say it's not something that you need actually to assess the person's drive or motivation for it. When you think about drive. Incentive. In the world of business where I come from, incentive is easy. Basically, a salesman can be given an incentive to sell more. In the world of non-profit organizations, much more difficult to provide financial incentives. The incentive that that we often have to look for is the incentive that will come at the end of your life rather than the middle of it. But clearly, incentives do play a role in giving somebody the motivation to do something. A fundraiser. Better at fundraising if he has something of a stake in how many hundreds of thousands of dollars he can raise. Incentive is a natural human impulsion to perform in some way. Yep. Yes. I suppose it's a reward for doing a specific task more and more well. Does reward help?
Yes.
If you think about a salesman, if a salesman is given a monthly target to sell 1,000 bars of chocolate, let's suppose that he's told, fine, if you sell 1,000 bars of chocolate, you just get your monthly salary. If you sell 25% or more, you'll get a bonus of 10% of your salary on top. If you sell 50% or more, you'll get a 30% bonus on top of your salary. So he says, right, well, I want to earn my salary plus 30%. I'm going to go very hard after selling 1,500 bars of chocolate a month.
But this doesn't work in a business world. It probably doesn't work
yeah.
in a ministry.
Well, exactly. That's what I was saying. It's hard to apply in a ministry setting. Mm-hmm. It's not impossible, but you have to be very
thoughtful about it and careful about it. This is one book that everybody needs to be careful with, because sometimes you can provide an incentive to do something which then causes everything else to get neglected. But we can't ignore it as a constituent of motivation, of causing people to want to do something. One incentive can be just praise. Saying well done is as often as not an incentive. People want to earn that. Security is another element of will. Think about people who feel uncertain about their job prospects, or just uncertain about whether they're going to be able to do a good job. Think of people in your organization, perhaps, who hate to make a mistake. They're fearful that if they make a mistake, you will either be cross with them, or even in the final analysis, ask them to leave your organization. People are the more insecure they are, the less will they will have, the less motivation they will have to produce. So the more secure they feel, the greater will be the degree of motivation. So security is certainly an element of that. And fourthly in this area is role understanding, or perhaps role perception. Do I understand what it is that's expected of me? When Greg Pritchard asked me to take on the role of coordinating the Leaders in Christian Organizations network, I didn't know at all what would be expected of me. I'm not altogether sure that I understand yet. So my level of role understanding is still in development. But Greg was very helpful. He gave me a list of things that he thought were important in the job and what needed to be done and so on and at what point. So he's been an enormous help in developing role understanding. The greater the level of role understanding, the higher the level of motivation, the higher the level of will in this particular situation. So in every case, when we're thinking about somebody, in order to assess their readiness for a particular task, not to plan on whether they go into let's assume that they've got the job right now, and we're trying to assess, what kind of leadership should I give this person? Then the question is, what are they like as far as skill or will is concerned for this task? Where are they? So we ask ourselves, what's their level of aptitude? Are they good at these kinds of things? What's their educational background? Well, let's think about it. They did high school, they've been to university, they've got a degree in this subject. Yeah, I think the education level is adequate for this task. Now, what about training? Have they had any specific training? No, they've got no training. And if they've never done anything like it before. What about experience? No, this is really their first job doing something like that. Include on the basis of that, you've got two yeses in aptitude perhaps and in education, and two no's in training and experience, I would assume that skill will be low, relatively low. What about motivation? Drive? Yeah, they are somebody who is quite a drivenist. They're high energy level. They do like to go at it. Incentive? Well, the only incentive that we can offer in our organization perhaps is approval, praise, thanks and appreciation. But that's not bad. The satisfaction of knowing that we're working on something that has eternal value is certainly an incentive. Security. Well, how secure do they feel about making mistakes? Well, they probably feel they're going to make a lot of mistakes. They don't feel very secure about this. Low. Role understanding, well, it's very early days. They don't know yet. It's only just started. So that's low. In that case, in a person that is like that, I think we could reasonably say skill is low and will is low. Fine. What that's giving us is an indicator of how we're going to try to lead them. Let's think on a bit from here. Summing it up on readiness. How ready is this person to do the task?
Well, we've been talking about this.
And we use a kind of shorthand for this, which is the R is the readiness level. And we rank people from 1 to 4. Readiness level 1 is low skill and low will. That's the kind of person I was just talking about there. They may have good education, they may have a terrific background in it, but ultimately they haven't got any specific training, they've never done this before, so training and experience is lacking. You'd have to say skill is low. What about will? Well, yeah, they've got the drive to do it, they want to do it, but most of the other things are a blank spot. So we'd have to say no, their will is probably low. Now, at the other end of the scale, we've got the 4s. Somebody who's met all the different things. Let's go back a notch here. They've got the aptitude, the education, they've got specific training, and they've done this kind of a job before. Yes, they've got the drive. The incentive is what would normally be there. They feel secure in what they're doing, and they really understand what it is that's expected of them. We'd have to say that that person, high on skill and high on will. So then we've got the ones in between. And we need to figure out what these are. Well, basically, skill is usually a developmental process. We can provide skill to people. So probably this one is still relatively low, one relatively high. Skill develops first. And as skill develops, so usually motivation does. As somebody sees they're getting better at it, the will tends to go up, the drive, the security, and the role understanding improves a lot, even if the experience is still pretty low. In this case, usually what happens, we've got two kinds of R3 people. We've got, I'm going to subdivide this into what we call developmental R3 and a regressive. R3. Let me speak about those two a little bit. The developmental R3 is somebody who's come really through this process from the stage where they had very low everything, and they've been building up as you go. They've grown, they've developed understanding, some more experience, maybe they've had the training course. They've grown. And you can see getting better. They've developed the skills. But somehow they still hold get to it. And for that reason, their will is low. Not as low as this, but it's still, relatively speaking, certainly compared to the person who is confident and is person, one, they haven't yet developed the confidence that we need in order to really get stuck into the job. You can probably think of people like that. I certainly can. Maybe young people, a young man or woman, who's got the skills, your skills, you've seen them build them up, but somehow they can't quite fly on their own. It's a bit like at this time of year, you see, as you drive through Hungary and Romania, you see the stork sitting on their nests. It's a wonderful sight. I love seeing it as we drive through Romania and Hungary. See the storks on the nests, and you know that in a few weeks' time, the young ones are going to be putting their noses over the edge of the nest. But the time's going to come when those young ones need to start to fly. Well, I don't know about storks, but eagles, when that stage starts to get there and the eagles' chicks are ready to fly, but they don't want to, they...
At this point, there is a short gap of just a few seconds in the original recording.
They've fallen back in terms of confidence and ability to drive themselves to do things. Well, that's this person. They've got the skills, but they're lacking the will. Two types of R3. Well, I think enough talking from me for a little while, because I'm now going to ask you to do some work. If you what I'd like you to do is to work to try to assess the readiness of somebody for a particular task. Pair up with somebody you don't know. So we have to separate Romanians from people from the Netherlands and so on. But sit with somebody you don't know. And I want you to try assess their readiness using some of the... You do an A and a B. One of you is A, one of you is B. The A is the one doing the interviewing or the assessing, and the person B is the one who's being asked to do a task. And A will choose the task from the list below. A has to determine from a set of questions, which B must answer truthfully, whether B is prepared to do this job. So you get to choose the task. A does. It's not by agreement. A decides we want somebody to lead this Bible study or whatever it is. And now you've got to try to decide, is this person ready for the task? Skill and will. Okay. Over to you. The tasks are there. Lead a Bible study, or build a garage, or teach a children's Sunday school class, or set up a bookshop in your church, or discipline, possibly even fire a subordinate. That's a pretty tough one. So let me ask you to pair up now, if we've got pairs. 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. Okay, one will have to be a threesome. And we'll see how we go from there. Please form pairs. And let's go from here. I'll give you about 10 to 15 minutes for this task. You can swap over halfway through. Yeah, why not? Yeah, good idea. We'll do a swap halfway through. We'll do 10 minutes this way and then swap over and do it 10 minutes the other way. If it's too short, we'll take a bit more time. Joe, have you not got somebody to do it with? Have you got someone to do it with? Everyone's paired up. Then come and pair with me. All right, brother, you can be A, and I'll be B. Let's bring the chair over here so we don't get... No, you choose. I'm the bee. I'm the one you're asking to do a task. So you need to find out. You need to find out how ready I am for that task. Okay. I guess a total of probably over 20 years in one way or another, having people report to me. Yeah, over 20 years.
What kind of formal, what kind of training, or what kind of education background do you have in relation to managing people?
Well, I did an MBA at Harvard Business School. Was my specific education in that regard. That's really the only formal education that I've had in management. Management education.
Have you been involved in any specific training in terms of hiring, assigning responsibilities, evaluating work, reflecting, and then maybe deciding the people that want to speak to?
Yes, I've had training courses in appraising people, doing appraisals and interviewing people for that. I've done training courses in interviewing people to hire them for jobs. I've done training in leadership and in giving feedback and coaching to employees. Those are probably the main formal training that I've had. Yes.
Do you like to be in this situation of evaluating somebody and maybe even...
No, I don't like it.
Is it that you don't think?
Well, generally speaking, the reasons that if it needs to be done, I feel then for the good of the organization, it may be necessary to do it. Certainly appraising people helps them to improve what they do, so it might be good for the individual, and it might well be good for the organization.
Have you been able to help somebody who was required to removing that person from the situation that was supposed to be fired, but was still given some options for training or maybe some education or something else?
Yes, I did. Well, whether I
did.
No, I think I understand the question. In other words,
understanding your motivation in terms of how you are into the task.
Yeah. I think my preference would be to coach somebody so that they could do better. But there needs to be a limit as to how long you go on doing that.
You probably were.
Yeah. Because I can think of a situation where I had to fire somebody in the end. I'd given him quite a bit of coaching and discussion opportunities for mentoring. Yeah, I mean,
you've done the right thing.
I think that's right. I think that it's. Yeah, sorry, go on.
I was trying to see in terms of attitude. I did this because I had it on my computer.
Yes.
Do you have any questions for me as to what I could have asked more?
I think you probably. I think you asked very good questions, actually. Yeah, no, I think you asked extremely good questions. You covered it well.
The way I understand is that you have very good experience.
Yeah. Training.
Good training, excellent education. You are, I don't know what's the apt, what is
yes,
it?
Apt, yes.
Mm. And in terms of the incentive is associated with your responsibility.
Yes.
And you are going to be secure to doing this because you're responsible. You've done enough to help people understand the role and help them understand they don't get.
Yeah.
As for the, I'm not sure I understand what could have done to pick up the thing. I mean, not
determine that by establishing how strongly somebody feels about the for the organization. How important is the success of this organization to you? That kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, the other thing I had a question about is the regressive thing.
Yes.
I didn't really catch that.
Okay.
Because I would say, you know, everything was, all the arrows were up. The way I understood your aptitude to perform.
Yes. Yes.
But where is the regressive?
I'll give you an example from my own experience in this precise situation. A good many years ago, when I was at American Express, I had an employee. I was in the UK, but I had a world, and one of my ports was in was. Last, and he had me as a boss, but he also had a local boss who was the general manager of the Latin American operation. So he was responsible to two people in a row. The general manager of the Latin American operation was a very hard and very difficult man, and he just basically fell out with this systems guy who reported to me, and so I tried to reconcile as long as I could, and I tried to get the systems guy to work with this other guy. But basically, the general manager was the one that really ought to have been fired, but he wasn't my responsibility to fire him. And in the end, what I did was I said that we can't go on with this situation. We've got two people completely at odds. I don't think it was my guy's fault at all, but in the end, I had to let him. That was the only way I could resolve the situation. I let go the one who really was not, didn't have responsibility for the other guy. I felt very bad about that and regretted it for a long time afterwards. I think that would probably have caused me to lose confidence in my firing somebody. And my will to do that would drop right away. I knew all the skills, I had all the experience and everything else, but I wouldn't want to do it. It was enough to make me say, no, I don't want anything to do with this. You see the point? That's regressive. Maybe I made a mistake. Decision that morally I felt was wrong, and so on. Those things combine to give you a low level of drive, a low level of incentive, and a low level of security. The role of understanding is not a problem. But it's,
do you have a problem with understanding your role at a time?
No. I think that what I think the mistake that I did was I should have confronted the general manager properly, and I should have confronted his boss properly. Ultimately, he did get fired, but that was after all this. Thank you. It's an interesting one. Do you want to reverse the role? Well, so let's see. Setting up a bookshop in your church. Let's try that one. Tell me, have you got any experience in setting up any kind of a commercial operation, Jerry?
Yes.
Tell me about it. What was it?
I started two or three. One was in public, one was in
Displays.
Yeah.
Right. And are the, those three enterprises, were they successful or unsuccessful? Can you see what was what went wrong with the one that was unsuccessful?
Yeah, I think it was the legal system and the illegal competition. So to work ethically and write bills with my competitors would not do that. It would give me a message for a long time. So I have to shut down much
While you were doing it, did you have any training of any kind in doing this, in either, say, in the book publishing business?
No, I just did my responsibility was to set up the system to find the values that were used to select the
What kind of educational background have you got? Right. Okay. As far as books are concerned, do you like books? And do you have any sense of what people in your church, what kinds of things you would like people in your church to be reading? What kinds of things would you want them to read?
Basically, that's what I that's the whole setup. It's a curriculum for evangelism, society, English development, leadership development. This includes a lot of that material from workbooks, textbooks,
If I were to ask you to set up a bookshop in your church, how exciting would you find that prospect? How would you feel about it? Why not?
It's a matter of priorities. I am something that was more important. So time slot.
Right.
Actually, that was the thing I was afraid of going to be talking about.
If I were to take some of your other priorities away and ask you to do this, how would you feel about the job itself?
That influences the way I see the business.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have the second natural tendency. Not to set up the system. Maybe I could do that, but to see the thing take place or to see the finished product.
So how do you see the role of setting up the bookshop? What do you think the role is?
If I would say, how do I sell my books? Well, it takes 15 years of training, 2 years of training, years of training, and then helping them see the variety of resources that are available for them to use. Then they make a decision what they want.
Very interesting. Well, I mean, it's clear enough, I think, where you would be. I think you'd clearly be in the R3 area. You've got a lot of the skills that it takes, but you don't have any particular desire to do this.
I don't have any particular desire to do this.
Well, that's right. Whether
in terms of writing the song.
Yes, in terms of doing it. Yeah, sure. But what you're saying is, in principle, you love the idea of doing it, but you would like somebody else to do it.
That's it.
Okay. I think that's straightforward enough. Thank you. Good answers. Back together. Thanks, Joe. Well, that sounded as if it was a pretty good session. Any kind of discoveries that you made, not just about the other person, of course, although that is very interesting, and we certainly had a fascinating session, but any learnings for you that came out of that, things that you'd like to pass on?
One fact I didn't know where to put is time. The person has all the training, all the experience, everything, but just has no time.
Yes, sure. And that's
partly then we discovered, of course, it has to do with drive, because if the drive is high, then you drop something else.
Certainly. And ultimately, the question is, who sets the priorities in the organization? It's not reasonable to load yet one more task onto somebody's plate. It may be that this is a different issue, but you may want to say, well, in that case, how can we drop, I think this is one that you've got that I really need you to do, how can we take something else away from you and give it to somebody else? That might be an alternative. Yeah, interesting point, yes, sure. Time is a big question.
We noticed the cultural difference of how to approach these sorts of things.
Yes.
The American tendency, lots of will and skill is often brought up later.
Yeah.
But then, on the other hand, where you have to have all the skill before you can begin to think about, can I do this, and should we meet each other?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Okay.
There's one more in the
business
circles that you don't have in the business world, and that's the calling.
Yeah, calling.
You can see he's qualified in everything, but he doesn't feel called. So.
Yeah. And another way of that's a spiritual way of looking at it, but of course in a non-spiritual way, he says, yes, I can do it, but I don't want to. I've had enough of doing this. I don't want to do it anymore. I don't feel called to do it. We say in Christian sales, well, I mean, I don't want to do it as well.
But more difficult to deal with it.
It is indeed. It is. What do you say? Well, not okay. Right. Quite true. Quite true.
For me, one thing is for me very important, if you work especially in non-profit organizations, especially for the sake of the team and target, the whole area of incentives.
Yeah.
Americans may be better, but especially in Europe, we just think the Lord will give all the incentives.
Yeah.
And I think this is a kind of a huge weakness among Christian organizations that there is no appreciation. It's just, we don't work for me, I don't pay you money. So the Lord has to take care of for the appreciation,
Absolutely.
And then I think it's a quite...
I think business. I think so. Yeah. We'll talk some more about that in a little while, I hope, and get into that a little bit more. The questions that you find yourself... I mean, the real focus of this, of that exercise is, what kind of questions are you asking in order to find out? You need to, because your questions are what will take you to the truth, hopefully, the way that somebody is working. So you need to think about your questions a bit. Jello and I were talking, I had to remind myself, ask open questions, stop asking closed questions. Closed questions are those that require a yes or no answer. Open questions are questions which will enable you to, or will enable the person to expand on their answer a bit. And often it's the expansion of the answer which really tells you where they are. So we need to encourage ourselves to ask those open questions. How do you feel about this? what education do you have? Or what's your background? What's your educational background in this area? Rather than, have you got any training courses, what kind of training courses have you done? Where? What did you think of them? How did you get on with them? Those kinds of much more open questions will actually lead us in the kind of direction we need to go. Okay, good. Then let's press on. I want to talk, if we've assessed the readiness of the person for a specific task. Remember, we're not summing up the whole person. A person may be great at swimming, but they're no good at playing golf. There are two, so we don't write off the person as a sport player. We just simply say they're good at this and they're not good at that, or they're not yet good at this. So, task readiness. So let's think about leadership behavior. As far as leadership behavior is concerned, we've got a number of different possibilities. First of all, looking at it on this grid here, I'm going to go through this just to build this. I know you've got the whole thing on your notes there, but basically let me build it up for you so that you see how it breaks down. First of all, we can think of task load. Task behavior, task-related behavior, if you like, is very much focused on the task, what it is that has to be done. Taking some of these activities that we talked about in our exercise, lead a Bible study. Task behavior will tell the person what it is you want them to do. I want you to lead a Bible study. Task-related behavior will tell them how you want them to lead it, when you want them to lead it, what you want them to cover. All of this is very much task behavior, focused on the task itself. And that task behavior, there can be a low level of it, just says, I'd like you to run a Bible study, and the rest is up to you. Basically, that is zero to low task-related behavior from the leader. The second dimension, the second dimension is relationship building behavior, if you like. Again, range low to high. Relationship type behavior, like encouraging, praising, helping. All of that is relationship type behavior. And it's aimed at making the person feel good. So, two types of behavior. Specifically. And our challenge is to figure out, how do I do this? How do I measure out the right amounts of each? Because all of us do some of each. Let's start with this bottom quadrant. Again, using our abbreviation style, we're going to use, as far as leadership is concerned, an abbreviation of S for style. Leadership style, S. Over in this quadrant here, what we've got, as you can see, is high task, a high level of task activity, and a low level of relationship building. So again, what this sounds like is, I want you to do this. This is how I want you to do it, when I want you to do it. These are the components of the task. Is that clear? I'm not putting a whole lot of relationship building. I'm not being unfriendly. I'm not being nasty or unkind. Let's be clear about that. Low relationship doesn't mean being horrible. It just means I'm not spending a lot of time saying, well, I think you're going to do a simply terrific job on this. Because quite honestly, I don't know about that yet. What I am concentrating on is making sure that you understand exactly what it is that you're supposed to do, when, how, and what the key important elements are in what you do. High task, low relationship. And we call that directing. Directing. Secondly, still high on the task side, still a good deal of prescriptiveness about what's got to be done, when, why, and how, but now combining it with a good deal of relationship building. And that's exactly what we call that. It's the guiding one. The way we involve that at a higher level in relationship is that we perhaps give that person some participation in deciding what and how things get done. So that invites some participation. The first one, I've been directing. I'm saying this is what we have to do. This is how we do it. That one, I might be inviting participation in planning when we do it or how we do it. The task still needs to be done. There's still plenty of task behavior as to what we do, but now starting to invite some participation in there. High task and high relationship or guiding. Actually, we move on from here through this quadrant. This brings us into the quadrant, which is lower task, not nearly so much now of the how to do it, what needs to be done, when, and so on, but much more relationship in the form of participation and involvement in the task, in setting how it's done and where and why. And this one, where the leader is starting to step back a bit, step away a little bit, that's supporting. In terms of the eagle's nest, it might be where the eagle is just starting to take a few sticks out of the nest. It's actually saying, it's getting to be time to fly on your own. And then, finally, in the quadrant, this end, low task and low relationship, which we call S4. S4 behavior means I'm not telling you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, or why. I'm simply giving you the task to do because now you are totally competent to do it. And I don't need to keep you a lot of feedback and a lot of encouragement because you're now on top of it. However, delegating does not mean abdicating. Delegating does not mean giving it to you and forgetting all about you. It does mean giving you that responsibility, but it's still staying in touch. Four key pieces. But then we have to take it on to the next stage and say, okay, well, which of these do we use for when? Well, it's becoming pretty self-evident that when we try to match style to readiness, what we're trying to do is to apply that right combination of relationship and task. Task behavior builds up skill. And as we build up skill, we also build up confidence. You think about a new person who comes to join your organization. The day they walk in the door, they may have a certain amount of education, but they don't have any experience in your organization. They may have lots of, they want to do well, they want to perform well, but they're nervous and uncertain, and they're certainly insecure. So both skill and will quite low. So then the question is, how are they going to cope with it? Good afternoon, Adi.
Hello, I'm sorry for being late.
It's all right, brother. You're welcome. Task behavior builds up skill so that they know what it is that they want to do. And as that skill level increases, so the confidence level increases. Relationship helps improve motivation and confidence. So relationship, as we're feeding back and encouraging and praising and supporting, so their level of motivation will go up, and so will the level of confidence. So both of those things build confidence, but they do it in different ways. Now, sometimes people think that the thing that they most need to give to somebody who's a new employee is encouragement, praise. I'm sure you can do it. I have every confidence in you. You're going to be great. Now, those may be nice sounding. They're very pleasant to hear. The question is, are they convincing? What's a lot more convincing and a lot better in building confidence is actually showing somebody how to do something. Staying with them while they learn how to do it. Giving them the means to learn it. Coaching them through it. And feeding back when they get it wrong. That builds confidence much faster, actually, than the praise and encouragement. Which is why we're going to say that the task bit is what we need to do early. When there's a job to be done, there is needed. If there's a fire in this building, and I want you to evacuate the building, then I'm not going to invite a lot of participation in how we get out. I don't think we're going to have a committee meeting now to say who leaves the room first. What I'm going to be saying is, get out fast. There's a fire in the building. So participation, encouragement, feedback, and praise are not going to be something that I'm going to try to do. There's a job to be done. We need to do task behavior. Tell, show, explain, reinforce, and correct. So it's helping people to understand what needs to be done, how to do it the best way. No, that's not correct. Let's try again. Better. Keep going. That's task behavior. When we want the person up, then we need the relationship behavior. When we want them to feel good, feel as if they're making progress, relationship behavior comes in, the encouragement and so on. The question is how each one to use. We're going to try and put it all together here. As you can see, I've combined two grids here. First of all, here is the readiness of the individual. Down here, ranging to R4. And we can then put a nice line which helps us to figure out how much of each to give. You see, for the R1 person, over here, person. This is the kind of leadership that we want to give them. They just come into the organization, brand new. So what we want to try to give them is a good helping of task-related behavior. This is how you do it. This is what I want you to do. Try again. No, you could have done that better. Try doing it this way. Explaining, demonstrating, helping to understand all the way. In fact, this curve, you could say, is actually a combination of lots and lots of little steps. Instead of actually being a smooth curve like that, it's actually doing this. And this is task, well done, relationship. Task, no, this is the way you want to do it. Relationship, yes, that's good, you're getting it. No, now try doing it this way. You'll find it's faster. Yep, you're starting to catch on. Now, do some more of it. Try doing it faster. No, that's not right, try this way. Yep, very good. You're improving. Do you see? You're taking them through this curve here. High task, but continually developing them as they go. You're building that confidence all the time. And as you're building that confidence, so you can start to reduce a little bit the level of task instruction. So we work through that. This is the directing part. This is getting the job done and teaching them how to do it. We then come to the R2 person. Still quite a bit of skill to acquire. Still quite a bit. But they're really starting to get on. We can keep reducing task and we can give them lots of involvement, so they're growing, they're developing all the time. We give them relationship behavior in the form of participation, contribution to the process, planning and helping it to happen as they go on through this and on up to that peak point. So the person who is the R2, the one low skills but definitely being will, we give them much more participation and their skill level will keep increasing. And then we come to the S3, the one who's now got the skills but perhaps lacks the will either to get going, they can't quite bring themselves to do it, or else in the case of the regressive one, they've had a setback or a problem or an unhappy experience which has caused them to doubt themselves. They've lost some confidence and as a result of that, they're not nearly as ready to do the task as they were. And those people need a particular type of treatment. They know how to do the task, so we don't need to be telling them how to do the task. We don't need to keep telling them, this is what I want you to do, this is how I want you to do it. They know. But what we do need to do is to be encouraging greater levels of participation and involvement all the time from them. And gradually, as we come into this box, the R4 person, we can say, okay, I can hand over much more of this task to you. I don't need to tell you how to do it. You know. You've got the experience. Now you've got the capability to do it, and I know that you've got the desire to do it. So get out there and do it. It's yours. Do you see how we match the leadership style to the readiness of the individual for that task? That's the challenge. So when we're trying to think, what leadership style should I use? As I said right at the beginning, we're not going for comfort zone leadership, not the leadership that I like most to give, but rather the leadership that this person needs most at this stage of their readiness development. That's really what we're after here, to try to match the one to the other. If you think about it, what we're saying is we match. When we've got somebody who's got readiness level one, the style they most need is S1. S1, high task, low relationship. At level two, skill still low, but will much higher. Then what they need is S2. Still some task relationship, but much more involvement in the process. Much more involvement in the planning and directing. Readiness level 3. High skill, but not quite enough will to get them to pick the task up completely. There we need style 3, supporting. Not directing, not even guiding, but supporting. Yeah. And for the R4 person, the one who's high on skill and high on will, S4, leadership. Low task, low relationship. We don't need to tell them what to do. We don't need to keep encouraging them, "I'm sure you're going to do a great job." It's really handing over all the participation. But staying in touch, as I say. It's not abdication. It's staying with it. So, of course, in this one, we need to think about the other squares. Imagine what happens if you've got an R1 person and you give them S4 leadership. Got a brand new person, joined the organization, and you say, "I'm sure you're going to do a great job. Off you go and do it. Thanks very much. See you in a month's time." I know a guy who's, he was saying to me, "I don't know why I've had so much trouble with secretaries. I've had 4 secretaries in the last year and a half. And it's really bad. I can't imagine what's going wrong." So I said, "Well, that sounds strange. What do you do? What's happening?" He said, "Well, what happens is they come along and they just don't seem to know anything." So I sit them down at their desk. I leave them to get on and find out about things, and they never do anything right. And in the end, after about 2 months, I just have to fire them because they're no good. I just don't seem to be able to pick them right. He said, finally, he got somebody who was really good, and now he's completely confident in her. I said, "How come? I mean, do you ever tell them what it is that you want them to do? Do you ever tell them your expectations?" "No, I expect them to know that. They're secretaries. They're trained to do this. That's their job. Why should I have to tell them what to do?" Simple as that. He's never gone through any of this leadership process. No wonder he's had terrible trouble. It's just amazing that he's actually found somebody who's significantly more competent than he is at the process. We cannot expect to take somebody in who is an R1, give them S4 leadership and expect them to succeed. It won't happen. There's obviously degrees of degrees of error and degrees of accuracy. If you've got somebody who is R1 and you give them S2, it won't be great, but it won't matter terribly because you're still giving them pretty high task and high relationship. It won't hurt. It's just there isn't time enough in the day to do all of the high task and high relationship all the time. So if we're having to choose, what builds up confidence fastest? Task. So give them the task which they're crying out for. That's what they want. They want that much more than they want the encouragement and the praise. Imagine an R4 person being given S1 leadership. Highly competent individual, competent at the task, and also secure and comfortable in what they do. And you say, okay, well, what I want you to do, I want you to set up this bookshop for us in the church. Yep. What you'll need to do, you'll need to get hold of the bookseller's distributor first and talk to them about ordering. Yes, I know. I've done it before. So, okay, well, here's the phone number of the distributor. Would you like me to dial the number for you? No, I have made a phone call before now. Right? Very quickly, you turn somebody off if you give them high task behavior when they're seriously competent in their own right at it. There's nothing more frustrating than having somebody do that to you. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. I have, and it'll drive you mad faster than anything else. So, matching style to need, we try to match them accurately. Let's try a role play again. We haven't got enough, I think, for threes. We have got enough for twos. So let's get into twos again. Have I jumped the gun? I thought I'd... We'll just have A and B and no observer. Agree on the task, which is to be role-played. And then I'm going to assign to each pair a leadership style to be used. And A is to instruct B to carry out the task. Same task as before. Let me join you up into A's and B's. You can do the same groups or you can do different ones. Again, I encourage you to get together with somebody who you don't know. And so pair up with them. We've got a newcomer at the back there, Adrian Ban from Oradea in Romania. So welcome. Pair up if you would and carry out this task. You will need to agree on which task is to be role-played. And then we're going to reverse it after you've done it for 10 minutes. Reverse it. I'm going to ask you to give that leadership style to the person. Okay? Pair up first and then I'll give you a style. Okay, folks. Let's pull it together. So, how did it feel? Let's see. Who was there a couple where it really worked well? Where the readiness, you got the exact right readiness level by pure accident, that it worked really well. Hadi?
Without saying anything, he said, okay, I'll be A, and let's pick a topic, teacher in a Sunday school class. So the S4, which you have given us, kind of a really match because in fact I told him after that I'm overseeing this Sunday school ministries in the church.
Yeah.
So it kind of a really blended there.
Yeah.
But then when we turn around, we build a brush.
Yeah.
So from S4 we should have gone really down to at least S2, if not S1. So
very good. Craig, how did it feel on the receiving end to be on the garage one?
Oh, of course, it's very frustrating because you're being asked to do something you can't do.
Yeah.
And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're being launched into something that you just have no.
And without any real guidance.
Yeah.
So you're just
a pure statement of faith. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that was an S4 level. Delegating effectively to, on the one hand, to somebody who was well up to it, who's got, if you think about it, all the skill and all the will that could be needed. He's got the experience, got the training, and so on and so forth, and as well as the motivation, clearly there. To somebody who has absolutely zero of both for doing another task, but the same leadership style. You see how incongruent it is when you put those two together. Okay, what about, how about the other, let's start with the S1. How did that go? How did that work?
We have kind of discussed, because in a ministry-wise, you think in ministry context, where the high task, low relationship, you kind of think, okay, it could be high task and also high relationship, because you need to encourage person, and then you suggest you will come along and do the kind of help. That's a little bit kind of brought some kind of confusion with how you just say, you know, you need to do this, and person would feel in a way, is there any kind of really personal support behind that? That's one thing. Another thing is going through this exercise, it's helped to realize sometimes how you can be ridiculous. Sense that you're not actually helping or an encouraging person to do things, but actually more this level of will kind of taken down by the asking things what the person already knows and knows how to do. You often maybe would not realize being yourself in that situation.
Highly, highly demotivating to be told how to do something that you know very well how to do, in fact, possibly better than the person who's telling you. It's very demotivating. Yeah. Interesting. So that happened in your situation? Which way? How?
Yeah, it's moving one way that steps.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
He still here it is, and I was telling him how to go one. You wouldn't want me to. That's a ridiculous situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very good. Very good. Let's talk for a moment about this point that you raised about the relationship question, and especially in a ministry situation, you feel, well, I don't want to be just kind of giving orders, I want to be giving encouragement and so on. When we talk about this, it does not mean being unfriendly, awkward, directive in the sense of giving orders and not listening at all, this kind of thing. No, it doesn't mean that. What it means is that in this technical instance, when we're talking about relationship, what we're actually meaning is spending a lot of time trying to just build the person up, when actually the thing that will build them up the most, given that we only have so many hours in the day, the thing that will build them up the most is helping somebody who doesn't know how to do something to do it. That is the friendliest thing that you can do for anybody. The most brotherly or sisterly thing you can do is actually to help them to do it. And the thing that will help them to do it is to explain, demonstrate, correct, all of those things, which are all task-related. Now, that doesn't mean that we do it in such a way that they feel alienated or that you are a dictator or somebody who has no feelings, that you're just instructing them what to do and walking away. No, it doesn't mean that. But what it means is that rather than spend a lot of time inviting participation on something that you haven't a clue how to participate, if I said to you, if you've never worked in a college or a university before, and I say to you, I would like you to do this semester's timetable, an allocation of teachers to rooms and students and so on and so forth, go away and do it, and I'm sure you'll do a great job, then it would be highly anxiety-provoking for you, I think. If you've never done it before, if your level of skill is low, however good your level of will is, however much you may want to please, I've been very friendly and nice to you. I've said, I trust you to do this. I'm confident you could do a great job. But it's very anxious-making. So, my point is, I'm starting to repeat myself now. Task doesn't mean unfriendly. It actually means giving what's needed most.
Yeah, but it's helpful what you can explain it, because often when the folks say complaints toward the leader is because
yeah.
they become from people orientated or task oriented, and they kind of neglect this relationship.
Yes, yes, it's certainly true, and we run a risk in speaking about task and relationship that we don't get called task-oriented as opposed to people-oriented, and that means we just completely lose sight of the person. I don't mean that. What I'm saying is actually the thing the person most needs is the instruction how to do it, and so that they're clear in what we're asking them to do. Thanks for raising the point. S2s, was this you guys? How did this go? In which, in both respects, skill and will?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And with that leadership style, I felt that so much has been thought up already and done and planned out. I was demotivated, but in the sense that, okay, well, I'm just executing what he wants me to do.
Yeah.
I'm just a secretary, well, not in a poor or bad way, just a secretary. You know, take notes, please. Make sure you do that, make that call. So I took this less to heart. This is not really my job anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm just doing what somebody else wants. And I could have performed and had different ideas, but I just didn't feel like
yeah. Very, very good observation. Very good. And because S2 really is this quite strong task. There's some relationship, so there is some little level of participation, but not very much. You're right. And that's very necessary at the stage. But if you were actually over here in R3 or maybe R4, then that's going to be uncomfortable. You're going to feel exactly as you describe. Yeah, very good. You guys really did get hold of this one. Jan, did you have anything to add?
It was quite similar in my case. I was supposed to fire someone, and I appreciated, you know, being asked about, well, how do you feel, and how do you think that person feels, and here's what you should do. But I knew what to do, and being told don't make it too long, and all those instructions. I mean, you made a great.
Yeah.
So it's kind of similar, and it's important to match those styles. So.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. Good. So S2s, S3s, how did you guys get on? Sorry?
I had someone in my worship team who, this is an example, maybe we can, and maybe it's better to give an example for myself. I had someone in my worship team who had a kind of ring, how said that thing that
like a facial metal.
And I had to support him, and I tried to find why not to tell him
take it off. Why do you put the thing right there? why are you come on a stage with the thing? What do you try to show to the people? And I leave to one of my pastors to discipline him. Now, I wasn't the guy who was disciplined.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how did it work out?
He take it off actually.
Did he?
And he understand that it's
yeah.
He understand that he was supported by me. I supporting him.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Wolfgang, do you have anything to add?
Well, the other way around, it's I didn't get enough instruction. Just, you know, set up a bookshop and
yes.
The only question was what kind of books. Well, that I would have been able to decide, but the practical steps of how to go about it, what you have to think of.
Good. Yeah, and often that will happen. For somebody who's given S3, they're often at the lower end. But because we are perhaps in Christian organizations, we feel we have to be this bit more laid back, a bit more frank. We give all the gas to the relationship and not nearly enough gas to the task. Yeah, good point. Good observation. Okay, where are we next? Heinrich and Jelu. Yes, I gave you, what is it, S2.
S2.
Yes, because it's a slightly more tricky one. Yeah.
Guiding.
It's the guiding one, yes. It's starting to let chinks of daylight in terms of the participation into it, but not a huge amount. We're still pretty much on the show and tell. Yes, how did you get on here? What role plays did you do here, you guys? Right. Yeah.
And because it so happened that I had the, did I say hire or fire?
You said hire. Did you mean fire?
No.
From one extreme to the other. Yeah.
So he was very helpful.
Go on.
He added me to the process.
Did he? Right.
Good.
Good.
Just because
good.
I usually did that.
So my impression was he knew how what to do.
All right. And the other way about?
He had to build a garage.
And you used S2 for that, yeah?
Yeah.
And where would you say your readiness level is, Heinrich?
It was my readiness level is low to do it myself, but my readiness level is quite high if I can find people who do it and who like to do it. So that was my solution, to find the right people who are excited about this and just encourage them to do it.
Yeah.
And if not necessary, to support them.
Yeah. As somebody once said many years ago, there is nothing a man can't do who is handy with a credit card. Yeah, so yeah, it's good. Thank you. Right, and yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I can see that Scotland works as the forwards of individuals, they don't want money anymore. But in a context of the team, where you can give a task for the group of people, and readiness for those people not only the same, they could be one of them, could be S2, S3, S4. How would.
Yes. Let me just repeat the question for the benefit of the microphone, if you don't mind. The question is, taking these leadership styles, different styles applied to different levels of readiness, how would you apply it to a team which is made up of people with different levels of readiness in the team? It's a good question. Actually, leadership in teams is a whole extra, further set of development, because as a team they're different from the sum total is greater than the sum of the parts.
teams go through a development stage of their own as a team. They in much the same way as we go through R1 to 4 in individuals, it's the same with a team in because of how they develop in working together. And so actually what you need to do is address the team, where the team's readiness for the task is, as opposed to where the individuals in the team are. Because in the team you will have some people who are extremely competent. You'll have some who are highly inexperienced. So you can't treat them either, you can't use either S4 or S1, because for one or other it's going to be totally inappropriate. So actually you have to address the whole team. A team that's got S1 and S4, I would deal with as a team that is still very much in a developmental stage. And so they will actually need more task and less relationship, if I can put it round that way. Depending on what extent you are a member of the team as the leader, or simply the team's boss and telling the team to get on with it and do it using the boss within the team, which is the two things are somewhat different. Yeah.
What do you do if there are some members on the team who are on R1 level? They have been on R1 level for a long time. They don't seem to be moving anywhere.
Yes.
And they're in a senior position.
Yeah.
And you have some sort of say on how to solve the situation.
Yeah.
What do you do in this
yeah.
case?
Yes. That's certainly, it's unlikely they stay at R1, because however hard they try, they will develop some skills, right? So they will actually move up to 2 and 3. But that is where people get stuck, for one reason or another. And our job as leaders, actually, is to try to get people into the R4 stage as early as we can, because that's the only way we can actually move on and do other tasks ourselves, right? It's time-consuming dealing with our ones. It is. It just takes a lot of time, and commensurately with twos and threes. It's the fours that, in a sense, give us the freedom to go and deal with some our ones, right? So somebody who's, coming back to your question, somebody who's stuck as R2 and R3 will need some special treatment, some special coaching, and that's what I'm going to come on to next. So it's a brilliant lead for the next shot. Thank you. If I may reserve the question, but just to point the principle, our task is to get people from R1 to R4 at the earliest reasonable date. Because only when we do that can we then move on and help the organization to go on developing, by then dealing with R1s, because we've got the time to do it. And people who are getting blocked there are taking time unnecessarily. So we have to deal with that. Now, folks, we're a little bit early, but I think this would be a great moment to break, to have some tea or coffee, and some lunch, if you haven't had some lunch. And what I suggest, I think we would have, let me see what the time will be. It doesn't specify how long we have, but I suggest we go till, let's give ourselves about 35 minutes. Let's take a break till 3:15, and that gives those of us who've just arrived a chance to go to the bathroom, get some lunch, and the rest of us tea and coffee, stretch break, walk around the building, get some fresh air. Let's meet back here 3:15, okay? Thank you very much for your participation and attention. Fabulous. Just to recap where we are. In our situational leadership, what we're aiming to do is to match the style of leadership that we bring, S1, S2, S3, or S4, to the person's task-specific readiness. How ready are they to do this job? We've got something we want them to do. What level of skill, what level of will are they bringing to it? So the start point is, Where are they? And then we take that and we say, okay, what can I do to make sure that I deal with this this person in the most effective way possible? Well, let me match my leadership style to that level of readiness that I've identified they've got. That says, depending on their skill or their will, I'm going to give them more or less task behavior, more or less relationship behavior. And the four areas, as you think about it, come in, Jelu. The four areas: directing, guiding, supporting, and delegating. Different levels of task behavior, different levels of relationship behavior. Our purpose in all of this is to bring the employee to the maximum level of readiness as fast as possible. We want to get them from R1 to R4 as quickly as we reasonably can. Because at R4, they will be able to produce and to perform as well as they possibly can with the least amount of direction and guidance and support and so on from us. Which is a good situation because it then gives us the spare capacity to look after others and to start to bring them through that same process. Moreover, because I've talked about task-specific, I just want to emphasize this third point. Our style needs to change to meet different needs and different situations. Obviously, that means I'll deal with person A this way and person B this way and person C another way in the first place. But also, person A for this task may be very ready. They may be an R4 for this task. But if I'm starting to ask them to do something else, I shouldn't just assume that because they're really good at this one, they'll be really good at this one. I need to recognize that in moving them to this new task, it's conceivable that they are R1 on this task, and I need a whole different set of behaviors for this task. Now, it's also conceivable that they will get to R4 faster because they've already been through it on something else. The speed will vary. In some cases, it's months. In some cases, it's years. People usually think they're moving through it faster than they actually are, unfortunately. But that's just something we need to be aware of and to judge as we go along. So obviously, we need to keep reassessing. Where are they? When do I change? We can talk more about this as we go along, but having recapped, I'm going to go on to the next stage now, jumping past our role play, to really the third part of three parts that I would like to talk about today, and that is coaching and feedback. Do you think we can take these spotlights off? It was more slightly more comfortable without the spots. Does that feel better?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much, James. Right. Coaching and feedback. Something that most of us are not naturally good at. It doesn't just come naturally to most of us. We don't like to have to give feedback to somebody, especially if it's unpleasant feedback. We don't like to have to correct them and rebuke them and so on, unless we just happen to be built that way. So, the question about this is really, if we're satisfied with somebody, are we telling them? And if we're dissatisfied with somebody, are we telling them? And if I can quote the Apostle Paul, how can they hear without somebody teaching them? How will they know that we're satisfied with them if we don't tell them? How will they know that they're doing something wrong if we don't tell them? It's absolutely essential that we give them feedback. And with feedback comes coaching. The two are different. Feedback is telling them how they're doing. Coaching is telling them how to do it better. Helping them through the things that they're not getting right. Encouraging them to move in a different direction. And they're both a leader's task. I'm going to talk about this in terms of the coaching and feedback cycle. Because it is a cycle. We'll probably go through it repeatedly with different people. Sometimes repeatedly with the same person. Because that's really, again, what leadership's about. Splits into three sections. The first one is prepare. Let's assume that we have somebody who works with us, who you're responsible for as a leader. Maybe in my case, that might be, let's say, a lecturer, or perhaps I'm responsible for communications and public relations and that kind of thing. So I have a young woman who works for me who looks after that area. When she first came to work for me, she was a student who'd graduated from our business school, so I knew her as a student, but I'd not had responsibility for her before. When I weighed up where she was, as far as readiness and so on was concerned, I could figure out, well, she is very clearly R1. She had some education in our business school. She had some aptitude for it. She loved to... She had good design skills and just natural artistic skills, so she could communicate well graphically and in words. But she'd had no training in this aspect at all. And as far as the motivation side was concerned, while she wanted to do a good job, she was extremely uncertain that she would be able to do one, and highly insecure that she would make mistakes and that the next discussion we would be having would be to tell her that she was leaving. So, very insecure and anxious. So I tried to give her a lot of S1 leadership. That involved telling her what I wanted to do and how I wanted her to do it. So, some months go by and she's going along just fine. She's learned a number of different things that I wanted her to do, and she's made some good progress. But eventually, we get to a stage where there's something that's not working right. Let's suppose that, just to take the simplest possible example, she does a good job, but let's suppose that she gets to work every day half an hour to 45 minutes late. And I'm looking for her to do something, and I've got all sorts of other things to do, and I'm finding she's just not in the office, not where I expect her to be by the time she's supposed to be starting work. So it's a problem. I identify the problem. Raluca's getting here late. Okay. How serious is it? Is it a big deal or a relatively small deal? I need to decide that. Obviously, the situation will vary. In this situation, I might say, well, she may be getting here late. Is she also leaving early, on time, or late? If she's one of those people that just has trouble getting here on time in the morning, maybe if she's also staying 2 hours every evening, then probably I need to take it easy on this. I may want to talk to her about it. Maybe we'll change her working hours. I'm willing to do that. But if it was essential that she be there on time, for instance, if she was responsible for doing something really important like putting on the coffee, then I would want to make sure she was getting there on time. Right? So we have to assess the seriousness. If it's serious, then we're going to need to take it on a step further. If we say, this is really a trivial issue, I don't need to worry about it, stop getting het up, then I can stop this process right there. I don't need to give feedback about it. I can leave it alone. Let's assume that I think it's a sufficiently worrying problem, her late coming, that I do have to deal with. It's serious, it's going... But if it goes on, she's just going to get later and later, and it's going to start to affect other people, and by, it's not going to be acceptable. So rather than leave it to fester and get worse and worse, I'm going to tackle it. Okay, assess the seriousness. What are the root causes? Why is this? Why is she getting there late? Maybe she's one of these people who just doesn't like getting up in the morning. Maybe she lives at the other end of a tram route, which is a very difficult one, and digging up the tram lines at the moment, and everything is delayed, and so on and so forth. But basically, when people get late, get somewhere late, it's because they start late, usually. And so I would usually reckon that that would be the reason. But maybe she's got children to get to school. Maybe she has some other kind of problem. Now, I don't have to worry about that, but there might be various root causes. So before I start getting agitated about this, I probably need to consider what the causes are and accept that there might be other causes than what I have in mind. And then to develop some possible strategies, what am I going to say to her? What am I going to propose? What points am I going to make? All of these things are in the preparation stage before I ever sit down and talk to her about it. Now, one of the problems is with you and me is that when we spot a problem, we might, well, just as we're walking down the corridor and you see the person coming towards you and you say, I noticed you were late again this morning. What's going on? I really... Now, this is not a good moment to tackle what we're describing here in coaching and feedback. Much better to have thought about it a bit in advance and actually to work out what it is that we're going to say. That will be much more effective in the final analysis. Okay. Let's move to the next stage, which is to meet them. Rather than bumping into them in the corridor, we actually need to do something about getting together with them and talking about it. Now, this can be at a formal level of an appraisal, or it can just be saying, can we have a few minutes together this morning? There's something I need to talk to you about. But whichever it is, we probably do need a few minutes of privacy somewhere to sit down and talk about it. So, let's fix the meeting. That means picking a time, putting it in the diary, and deciding that at that point you're going to deal with the issue. First off, rather than beating around the bush and talking about the weather, the football scores, and anything else that we can think of to avoid the topic, let's get to the topic reasonably quickly. Raluca, I've been concerned. I've noticed that for several days when I've been looking for you early in the morning, I found that you're not there. And what I found is that this is starting to be a bit more than just an occasional thing. It's starting to be a habit. So I'd really like to hear from you what's going on. What is going on? Open question that gives her the opportunity to talk about it. Explain your concern. What's going on? This now gives her the opportunity to explain, the problem is that the tram lines are being dug up all over the city, and my particular route used to take half an hour. It now takes anything between 45 minutes and an hour and a half, and it's very unpredictable what's going to happen. Okay. All right. Well, that's not an unreasonable response. But this is a problem as far as we're concerned, too. Do you accept that this is a problem? Can you see that this is causing difficulties? Okay, yes, I understand. This is something that we've got to try and solve. So what can we do about it? What can we do about it? Well, there are various options, aren't there? I don't know what the options in this particular instance might be. Is there another route that you could take? Can you get a friend to drive you while this process is going on? Are you able to make some kind of other arrangements? Would it help if we altered your working hours? Can we agree on another method? If you get here 45 minutes late, you will always work 45 minutes extra at the end of the day, and so on. We ought to be able to find some kind of solution. There's various options. That's what we're talking about here. Let's get some options on the table. We agree needs. Well, in this particular instance, I'm not sure what a need might be, but let's suppose that we had somebody who was struggling with their job because they didn't know how to do something. Let's suppose that you've got, let's say, a secretary who's fine on working with Microsoft Word, but increasingly what you're asking her to do or him to do is to work with figures, which means moving to spreadsheets, and they've never really learned how to use Excel. So a need might be, I need to understand how to use a spreadsheet. You've asked me to do several, and I'm really struggling with it. I need a training course of some kind. Okay. Well, let's do a training course. Let's get this need dealt with. Agree on the need and commit to some kind of improvement goals. Either you're getting here on time, or you're working extra time at the end of the day to compensate for time that's been lost at the beginning. But ultimately, if other people are depending on you to be there for the time, then that's not going to be an acceptable option. So we're going to have to figure out what the best solution is that meets the actual requirement. How flexible you can be, that depends on the case, doesn't it? It depends on the particular situation. But we need to commit to those specific improvement goals. And then, on that basis, you can close that meeting. It doesn't need to be nasty. It doesn't need to be unpleasant. It doesn't even need to be argumentative. But it does need to be clear. It can be perfectly reasonable and firm without being unpleasant. Recommendation is that actually you write it down. Write down what you've agreed. Whether you both sign it is a different matter. I think in a case of something seriously, a real serious issue, then you may well want to get something signed. If somebody, for instance, has been behaving in an inappropriate way, for instance, if it's a serious disciplinary issue, a lecturer who's been acting wrongly with students, perhaps, something that you would really want to put a very firm stop to, then you may well need to put something in writing. If it's a matter of being half an hour late on some mornings, I don't think I would go to the extent of getting signatures on that. But I think I would say that just about anything is worth putting in writing in some way, even if it's an email that says, thanks for our meeting this morning. I'm glad we were able to agree on the problem. And I just want to confirm that you're going to make every effort to be here on time. I recognize that while the tram line repairs are going on, it's hard for you to do that, but we've agreed that you will make up any time at the end of each day when you are in late. But on the whole, I want you to aim to be here on time. It's in writing. Send it off. Ideally, get them to respond. I would appreciate you responding to this email, maybe. Depends how serious it is. For a disciplinary offence, email is not appropriate. It needs to be on a piece of paper that gets signed by both parties, really. Okay? So, this then enables us to monitor it. How's it going? What's happening on it? Well, if the problem goes away, great. How wonderful. I think if the problem goes away 3 or 4 weeks later, it's very well worth saying, well done. The problem's been solved. That's great. I'm so glad to see that we've worked it out. But on the other hand, monitoring the goal performance might turn up the result that you actually haven't. The behavior has not changed, whatever it was. Well, in that case, You need to feedback promptly. You need to feedback promptly. It cannot be left for 3 or 4 months while nothing happens. We actually have to get to grips with the issue again. Now look, we sat down 3 weeks ago and we agreed that this is what we were going to do. And for the first 4 or 5 days, everything seemed to go fine. But I've noticed that in the last 2 weeks, it's slipping again. Now what's going on? How come it's slipping? You know what we agreed. So you catch it before it's got to the stage where it's being abused all over again. So the promptness of our action needs to be geared, again, to the seriousness of the topic and the degree to which the behavior is being repeated. Obviously, if it's a one-time thing, you know, just one slip, we don't need to make a big deal about it. But it's where it's starting to be an abuse again. That's where we need to step in again. And, of course, assuming that it's going well, we do need to stay in touch with what's going on. That is really, summing it up, the coaching and feedback cycle. It's when we see a problem, we actually do something about it. Now, for my brothers and sisters from Eastern Europe, confrontation of these kinds of things is not usually a very comfortable thing to do. It's easy for in an Anglo-Saxon environment to do it. But I do know that in Eastern Europe, it's much harder culturally to confront these kinds of things. The problem is that what that does is it stores up pain for the future, because ultimately what it does is it causes great pain at the end of the process, because suddenly somebody has to jump round all the way to the very end. So for those of you who culturally find this particularly challenging, my recommendation is still that you consider using it, because it actually winds up saving a lot more pain, even though it causes some shorter-term discomfort, because it actually gets to grips with issues early on rather than when they've gone a long way. Let's pause there and ask for your comments or thoughts on that.
Questions?
Absolutely.
What to do if that person doesn't see it or recognize it as a problem?
Yep. Well, there's nothing quite like facts for dealing with an... repeat the question. Thank you very much. The question was, what if the person doesn't recognize that there's a problem there? As I say, facts can make a great deal of difference. If you're dealing with something that is a behavior that you have perceived, the getting there late is one obvious example, then you can point to specific instances. If the person simply isn't accepting it, then maybe you have to make absolutely sure of your facts and revisit it at a later stage. If they're in complete denial, you may well have to make certain of it.
But, like, being late is a cultural issue.
Being late is a cultural issue,
so,
yes. So, it's sometimes...
So you think he's late, but he says, well...
Yeah, I am, but half an hour is nothing, yes.
Right.
As in Romania, we have English time and we have Romanian time, and they're usually somewhat different. Yeah, that certainly happens. I think that, again, it depends on how serious is the issue. If it's a serious one, then we have to tackle it in some way and lay down those expectations. You may not perceive this as a problem, but as far as I'm concerned, it is a problem. And in the final analysis,
I'm calling the priorities here. Sorry, but there it is. We don't have to be unpleasant, but we do need to be clear. Go ahead.
I think one concern I have is about motivation for work. And what I've noticed in some situations is that people are trained to work not efficiently, and that's what everybody does. And when they move in a context where everybody works hard, they're completely messed up. And then we can become very defensive, and there's almost no way we can get them to work. I tried various ways, you know, mentoring the team, having the team reflect on that, having a person report to me, it didn't work, having a person report to everybody in the team. So I think I played with all the buttons I found.
Yeah.
But what do you do with somebody who says, you know, and the next step it was trying to motivate, the next thing was, okay, I'm going to try to, cut some of his income or something, cut his income. Or one feedback I said was, oh, well, I'm fine with that. I don't need more. You know, the first thing was, the first thing I did was, I said, I'm not going to raise your salary anymore. If you don't do this, you're not going to get a raise. I'm fine with the money I make. It doesn't make a lot of money. So I'm not sure I understand the problem.
Yeah.
But you've been working in Romania also for a long time now. So,
so the question really is about how do you motivate somebody to work at the pace that they're at the level that you're expecting? Half a level you're expecting. It's a huge question, quite honestly.
Our team, let's say we have several teams in Romania. Church team, they work hard.
Yes.
I think they're working too hard. And this is great. It's the best, the dream team that we have. Now, when we try to replicate it in a place or try to bring people in a team, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's a culture that has been developed for 15 years. Yeah. So we just take things for granted, but that person can come outside and just finds himself in the new world.
Yeah. I mean, really what you're dealing with here is a question of how you recruit. How do you hire people with the who have the same level of motivation as your existing team?
Yeah, that would be a preemptive thing.
Yeah.
How can you do that?
Yeah.
Start with them. Oh,
yeah.
Well, how can we motivate?
Yeah. There are no easy answers on it. I think you just ultimately it's a question of whether somebody has the heart for it. But this coaching and feedback cycle does at least identify to them and to you that there's a problem going on here. You talked about various punishing mechanisms like not raising salary or actually cutting salary, for instance. I think the not raising salary might be a mechanism that we would use, but actually cutting salary, I think, was not one that I've come across using in the West. I've certainly come across it in Romania as a punishing effect. I think that getting people to work at an expected level needs to be very much specific. In other words, you can't say, I expect you to work harder. I think you're much more into saying, I expect this job that you're doing to occupy only one day per week instead of 5 days per week, and I expect you to be able to do these other things as well. Now, how can I help you to do that? What is it that's holding you back from doing that? So that's what this is. This is dialogue. It's not monologue. And so it's the idea is to get them involved. Perceiving, getting the acceptance that there is a problem is a challenging thing. And then figuring out some improvement options, how you do it, how you get that better. It might be a step-by-step thing. Rather than just saying, I expect you to work harder, he says, I want this to be done in a different way. And then I want this to be done in a different way. And I'll help you to see how it can be done.
The first thing, I mean, there's several things we've done. One thing was to help the person write a daily and weekly report so we know what he's doing.
Yeah.
He doesn't do it. He said that after, you know, half a year, he says, well, I probably need to be fine or, you know, have my salary time. I don't do it.
I look at the poor, dear brother, whatever, pastor. You know, he doesn't do that.
At that point, yeah. What does anybody else think? Anybody else got any thoughts?
Nobody has this problem.
So just a little feedback on writing reports. Well, it's a good thing for people who want to improve their own work for personal self-motivation. It's a great tool to know how you spend your time, how much is planned, how much is unplanned, exactly how you spend it. My experience from an organization where I worked was the people who were doing the least amount of things at business reports ever. You know, these people would if you read it, say, wow, this person is doing a lot. But the actual output was not that impressive. It was more like 50% of what they were doing is were writing just terrific reports.
Yeah, but we know that. But it should be in the report. For example, I see if a person spends 37 hours a week to prepare and works 3 hours a week, then we have a problem. You know,
yeah.
He needs to be probably working something else. Mm-hmm. So that's what I need to know. In order to help somebody improve, you really need to know how is he dealing with money, with time, with relationships, and so on. Mm-hmm. And we try various ways to understand and fix.
Ultimately, there comes a point where we have to recognize that there's no fit between this person and what we're trying to do. And, I mean, if they are not sufficiently self-aware or willing to fit with the
ethos. Better than everybody from the place he came from. He says that's the way we work. He's talking about pastors and
It's a real struggle. This is not fooling around. This is genuine. I know. The problem comes from somebody who was more than 20 years old at the time of the revolution. They find change extraordinarily difficult to make. Mm. It's a fact. It can be done sometimes, but very difficult. As we were saying in the break, a 2x4 is sometimes the only answer.
Is that person? So if that person is not working just his own problem or sort of...
No, he was hired to pick up some responsibilities. So I work 90-45% of the time I should be working. And we pay somebody, double that I get to take 25% from myself, 10% from somebody else, and something like that. And we really need to know, are we really getting even? So
are you getting value for money? Yeah.
These church responsibilities, and I think it's a general responsibility. When we finally came to the decision that we need to promote him, meaning that he'll get rid of him. That's what you do in Romania. But we had to find ways, and it was a prophetic message. He asked me to do that, and reflect on what happened. That reflected on John. This process, I feel kind of guilty because it didn't give me more, even though hire me to get more work for myself. I said after several days, I said, I think you need me to be your assistant.
Unfortunately, you've got another job to do, yes. I think, as far as this is concerned, the dictum that I've always tried to work with using this is that discipline, to have to discipline somebody, including having to fire them, should never come as a surprise to the individual. Should never, if nothing else, we can say that this person knew there was a problem and that this was something that we were trying to deal with, that I'd given them ample warning, ample opportunity to improve. If I can lay hand on heart and say, this should come as no surprise to somebody that we're actually saying we've reached the end of the road and it's time to go, then fair enough. Now, firing is, of course, really at the end of the road, and it is an admission of defeat in many ways. It's sad, but it'll happen. Hopefully, not very often. Hopefully, we can rescue somebody. Hopefully, we can make the right hiring decision in the first place. But we make mistakes. That's inevitable. We do. Because we are not God. We look on the outside. We do not see the heart. That's we're mortal. We just try to avoid the mistakes as often as we can. Any other comment, any other observation you'd like to make before we move on?
it's about this recorded agreements in writing.
Yes.
Sometimes this could come up as a kind of I would not trust, you know. Kind of would come to a common agreement.
Yeah.
And if I kind of would suggest let's kind of write it down or agreement, the opposite person would take this as a sign of distrust.
Distrust. Yes. They can, especially if you're asking them to sign it or something like that. This is why I say, let me just repeat the question for you. You're saying that if getting somebody's agreement to it in writing and getting them perhaps even to sign it could be interpreted as a sign of distrust on your part. That is true. It depends on how, on how we do it. Mm-hmm. If you are not used to recording what happened in a meeting in writing at all, then it will tend to be interpreted that way. Mm-hmm. If you can make as a practice something that you just actually jot down notes that you both agree on on what took place in a meeting, that's probably quite a good habit in any case. As far as this getting agreement and then getting it in writing is concerned, I'd repeat what I said before. It depends on the seriousness of the issue. If it is a really serious issue, a disciplinary issue, an abuse issue, or something like that, where the next step might be termination or something like that, then I think you do need to record it in writing and get signed on it. Especially in Europe, where we have disciplinary processes that require first warning, second warning, and so on, where you have to go through this disciplinary process, it may be absolutely essential to do it. But regardless of whether it's part of the disciplinary process or not, it's good as a discipline for ourselves to record some things in writing. Whether you then get it signed or not depends, as I say, on the seriousness. I would certainly, for a less critical issue, I would just send an email saying, thanks for the meeting, just to record for us both what we agreed. This is what we agreed. 1, 2, 3. Thanks.
It seems to me, John, that two things are that it's easier, I think, much more used in business than in Christian organizations. Because, you know, you just get my money, you work for my company, so it's much easier to do.
It's an economic bargain, yeah. Yes.
And especially in order to protect the company.
Yep.
Case. The other thing is, I suppose, especially, I assume you are from East Europe.
Yes, yes.
And I think in the East European culture, it's much more difficult because sign is almost to sign your death sentence.
Absolutely.
Right?
So yeah.
That makes it much more difficult
I think
for
that's
this
right.
culture to sign anything. And email is much easier than just
yes.
signing.
Yes. Yes. I think the signing. Just to confirm what you're saying, I think the signing really is a major and a serious step. I wouldn't try to get into that for the regular coaching and feedback process, but I would record it in writing. Just, and I think an email is the most effective way of doing that because it's both sufficiently informal that it's not threatening, but it's sufficiently formal that it records it. I just would tend to use it if we could, but again, you need to suit your culture. Adi,
would you do that kind of talk a bit about this model in terms of working with volunteers?
Yes. Thank you.
I think there is one perspective when you have somebody that is important.
Yeah.
And you know you have a contract.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
But when you work with volunteers, would you please talk about this?
Sure. I think that you're absolutely right. Working with volunteers adds a whole extra dimension. It is a bit like herding cats at times. It's tough to do. It's tough to do. At the same time, volunteers. Let me start out with the initial assumption: to volunteer to work in an organisation is a voluntary act. But having volunteered to work for that organisation, it is an obligation to take on the to take on the norms and requirements of that organization. To give you a very simple illustration, my wife and I used to sing with a very big choir in the south of England. And that was a completely voluntary act. We did not get paid for doing it. It was a tough regime. So you volunteered to join this choir. Great, that's a voluntary act. Having volunteered, it was an obligation to attend choir practice every week on a Tuesday night. And if you missed more than, let's say, two or three choir practices as you were coming up to a major event, you would be disqualified from singing in that major event. So it was very clear and very tough discipline. Volunteer for something, fine, but you then have some obligations. Now, in this instance, when we have a volunteer, let's assume we have a volunteer and they are doing something which is causing us a problem. This is all negative feedback stuff. Positive feedback, we can pour on encouragement and praises. That's not a difficult thing to do. But negative feedback does mean doing something like this. And volunteers do sometimes do some dumb things and some undesirable things. When that happens, basically, we need to go through much the same process. The how may be somewhat different, but we will need, if we've identified a problem, assess how serious it is. Is it something I need to get involved with? If it is, then why is it happening? Is it because they don't understand? Is it because we haven't been clear? Is it because we need to do something to make sure they do understand? Do they need some training? Develop some strategies from it and go on. I think that all the way through, the steps are much the same. The only thing that will be different is what the sanctions are that you have to apply. Because you can't say, I'm going to not give you a raise this year, this month, because you're not paying them anything. And you can't threaten that easily, but what you can make clear is why it's a problem. What it's doing to the organization. Why you don't want them to behave in this particular way. I don't know if that helps, Adi, but essentially what we've got, the fact that they're volunteers does mean that we don't have the economic sanction, but the fact that they're volunteers lays an obligation upon them to comply with the norms and the code of behavior of the organization.
Mm-hmm. To it, and that can really play an important role really working with them. But if I make a now parallel between what's happening in the Western world in terms of coaching and feedback, and we said it's getting harder by the time we move east.
Yes.
And I think there is also a parallel between volunteers in the West and volunteers in the East.
Yes.
Because it is impacted on. So sometimes people will just say, well, if you don't take me the way I am here, I'm out of here. And he or she would not just be pleased with that attitude, but will try to influence the others. So then you become, it gets a lot of,
yeah.
That's why I saw many times in local ministries that attitude of, okay,
we'll live with it.
Let's do something,
yeah.
Or let's
yeah.
cut some corners here, or,
yes.
Just because if they leave, then we are...
We're in, I mean, what's the alternative? Again, it comes back to assessing the seriousness of the situation. If this is a serious enough problem that we need to act on it, then we probably have to act. If it's not serious, if it's a choice between having this, living with this problem so that the person stays. And not living with the problem, in which case the person goes and possibly criticizes your organization or runs it down to other people, then you're having to make that choice. There are some behaviors which are intolerable. There are some which you can live with, and there are some which you would rather not live with, but which ultimately you may decide for the best of the organization. I know an organization like that which has sort of lived with an awkward person in the organization, somebody who's just difficult to get along with, awkward, angular, argumentative, unhelpful, but who has some very, very important skills. And so they've kept them in the organization for quite a long time. But ultimately, it does affect the effectiveness of the ministry. It's a difficult one. It's a cultural thing, dear folk. It is easier in a Western culture to tackle it, even with volunteers, I think. All that I can offer is sympathy, prayer, and encouragement. I've just given you a whole lot of relationship behavior. And what you need is some tasks here. Okay. Anything else? Yes, yeah.
I found it a little trick how to get people to sign something without getting their handwritten signature. When you write an email, here's what you can do. When you tap on the memo in Word, this is a little trick. Okay? You tap on the memo in Word and then zip it, email it to them, and ask, were you able to read the document? Were you able to open it and read it? And if they say yes, then you pretty much got the signature without, you know, having them sign a piece of paper. It's a feedback from their side. And if this is something you'll confront them about in the future, they're very rarely ever deny that they wrote that email. So this is kind of a little trick that you can do. Either get a read receipt that you get automatically or after their approval. But this is even better when you send it as an attachment and ask them, were you able to open the attachment? And if they don't respond to you, then you just ask again, well, did you get this email? Were you able to open it? And eventually they will respond. So, what do you think about that?
What does anybody think about it?
We tried something like this with a court executioner. Instead of asking, I mean, there was a lady who worked in a volunteer who did the bookkeeping in a crisis prevention center. For 4 years, she never came to the meetings, like the board meetings. We tried everything. I mean, five of us, six, seven, several of us were pastors and leaders, and we were kind of waiting at the door to open the door and so on. You know, beloved Christian, this lady. Well, finally, we did some changes. We got her out of the board. But she was a founder, one of the founders in the system. So finally, with this not taking to court, you know, we were kind of trying not to take it to court, and we went to a lawyer, and we wrote the document to the executioner, and she said she didn't receive it. Actually, she signed for it, because that's the way they deliver the mail. Mm-hmm. It's painful. 4 years.
We are talking out the outer limits here of coaching and feedback. Thank you, Joey. That's a great example. I think the only problem that I have with your description is it feels manipulative at my end. And ultimately, you know, if we can't get people facing up to things openly, then we've got an even bigger problem than the disciplinary problem we started out with. In the majority of cases, you're not going to have to go through huge... you're not going to have to turn cartwheels and somersaults in order to make these things happen. Mostly, this is a conversation to try to get somebody to help somebody to improve. Look at it that we're trying to help rather than we're trying to discipline or we're trying to punish. And in that case, if the purpose of sending something in writing is simply that we just both agree this is what we be talked about. And that's really the main purpose. And if you disagree, if you think this is not what we talked about, please get back to me, because I'd like to know, in which case I need to straighten this out.
Manipulative, but for example, when I talk with someone, or even with my boss, and he says, "Oh, yeah. I agree that you will get a vacation week for the European leadership training."
Mm.
So I just send it to him, and just you know, make sure that he gets it, and somehow responds to that.
Yeah. When he catches on, you'll have problems.
Yeah.
Pauline.
This is just when it turns out that the situation that somebody, let's say in your team or under you, identifies a problem. Oh, so and so is not doing his job, and it's really frustrating us. So then, what would you do? In some situations, I've jumped right into doing something about it. And then I find out, well, maybe actually it wasn't such a big problem. It was the person who complained to me that was the problem. So scenario one, I'd like your comments. The second thing is that I don't know if there's a good way to tackle, because in the Chinese or Asian cultures, it's a little bit maybe similar to what you refer to as the Eastern European culture. I mean, having to confront sort of like the last card kind of
absolutely,
very, very embarrassing.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to do is, like, after I think there's a problem, then I do the sort of general email or general announcement thing. Well, I think, let's say, you know, neatness is a big, very big thing, and it's a safety issue, blah, 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 so I think we should do this without saying a so-and-so has a big problem. Is that good or bad?
Okay. Let me just repeat those questions, but for two purposes. One for the microphone, but also to make sure I've understood the questions. The first one was to do with hearsay. Somebody comes to you and says, "So-and-so is not doing a very good job. I think they're lazy or whatever it is. What do we do about that?" And the second question was to do with how about an approach which says, rather than picking somebody out specifically for their behavior, rather addressing a group of people and saying something like, we need to improve our timekeeping in this group, or something like that.
That's a cycle that you go through before you actually, and if it doesn't improve, then you go for it, so the one-to-one meeting.
Yeah, so possibly. Did you want to contribute something?
Then the person, is the person not more embarrassed, because the person just knows that you have embarrassed in some way the person in front of all others. That's my problem, because at the end, people smart enough to understand to whom the message goes. So
depends on the culture, and it probably depends on the actual circumstance, the offence, or whatever it is that's causing the problem. If it's something this is typically the things that we hate to address in this kind of situation is where somebody's not showering often enough or not using an adequate deodorant. This can be a very embarrassing and awkward problem, and to have to face it. With a class of students I had at one time, I was fairly sure who the offender was, but it was becoming oppressive in the classroom at times. And because they were a first-year group, what I said was, one of the things that nobody has talked to you about when you come away from home for the first time is you've probably not been given clear instructions, all of you, about showering, personal hygiene, and getting your coat dry cleaned from time to time. So I gave them some very clear S1 leadership as a group, as you say, without picking somebody out specifically and saying, "Cosmin, you have a problem, brother. You have to deal with it." Ultimately, having given that talk, if the problem didn't improve, and there was a lot of laughter and kidding around, and that was fine. It was with students; it's easy. With a working group, that much harder, because of course you're dealing with other adults and you're dealing one to one, much harder. And people would know, in a sense, who you were talking about in that circumstances, as Hani was saying. Ultimately, I think that these things have to be dealt with one-to-one especially if, having tried to approach it tactfully, it's not worked. It ultimately has to either be lived with or approached one-to-one. Coming back to your first question, which I have now forgotten what it was. Just remind me.
Hearsay.
Thank you. Hearsay. My feeling about that is that I would not immediately go and talk to the person and say, I understand that you have really been goofing off in your job and not doing what we expect you to do. Now, this has got to stop. Because I'm almost certain to wind up with egg all over my face when I do that. Instead, what I would try to do is, first of all, I would try to find out some facts. If I've been given this kind of a hint, then maybe that does give me... It's sufficient reason for me to look into it, say what's going on, to try to get some facts about it. I think that I would probably... as well, I would be very, very cautious about taking somebody else's criticism of someone just like that. But I wouldn't ignore it, because I do think it needs to be looked into. It may not be possible to establish the facts, so it may be necessary for you instead to wait and watch for a while, to observe, to ask questions of other people, not necessarily direct, but basically using your ears and eyes and antennae to try to identify the problem more effectively.
It related to that, I'm wondering, do you think it is right to ask someone else, what do you think about so-and-so?
Yes, I think it is doable, but it has to be done with very great care. I think I would also probably, at an opportune time, I would also ask questions of the person themselves. How effective do you feel you're being in your job? Are you having any particular difficulties? How do you get on with your colleagues? Where have you got relation? Are there any relationship issues in our department? These kinds of things. Because you're also trying to establish, is there a relationship problem here that somebody's trying to put down? I think I'd try to get at it through a number of questions. As you do that, you would start to find that things would become clearer. Because as you look into it, as you ask the questions, as you use your eyes and ears, having been alerted to something, you may well find something. And even if you find only one aspect of it, then you can probably bring that up with the person and say, look, I noticed that although we expect you to be turning in a weekly report, you're about 6 weeks behind at the moment. Now, what's going on? Is there some reason for that? So you're starting to dig in a particular area where there's a fact that you can point to. They say, yeah, no, I'm sorry. It's because I'm getting snowed under with some other... Are you having a bit of problem in that area of the job? Why? Is there something that we can help you with on that? Is there some reason you're getting behind there? Does that make sense?
I guess it's just us trying to, you know, do all our homework in preparation... Yeah. Before that confrontation,
yes.
Sort of traumatic.
Yeah. You need to, try, it doesn't need, this meeting does not need to be a confrontation or traumatic. It's a meeting to talk about a perceived problem. If that problem is genuinely there, then let's try and get at it. If it's not there, fine. Okay. I just wanted to ask, because I got some sense that there was something that's not quite right here. I wouldn't say so-and-so says that you're slacking and goofing off at every opportunity. Anything else on this? This is really a key area of leadership, I think. It's the way that we do get improvement. at American Express, where I first started learning about this feedback cycle, it really, once people were trained in doing this, it made a huge difference to the level, to the average level of performance in the organization. It just made a big difference.
How much sort of easier it gets as more people are aware of these sorts of things. You know, you said getting people from R1 to R4. Well,
yes.
R4s have probably been through this cycle themselves.
Yes.
And so there's more of this about. There's more of a, even like the Christian body functioning well. And so when someone isn't functioning well, it's obvious to more than just one person.
Yep.
So it's not just the person in leadership who has to pay attention to everything. They might have assistants with them who are noticing things. There might be more appropriate relationships for dealing with it.
Yeah.
Like there are a lot of different ways
this can
work. It isn't always negative.
Indeed, it's not. And often it's often a matter of actually improving performance as opposed to correcting bad performance. It's a way of actually raising the level of performance, raising the bar on it. And it can even apply to a mentoring relationship as opposed to a boss subordinate relationship. In a number of instances, when I've worked with somebody in a mentoring capacity, I've tried to use this same thing to try to help them to deal with a problem that they themselves identify. I have this problem. I don't know quite how to deal with it. What should I do? Well, then we can go through that.
I just want to add, as what you said, is to stress on the importance of your motivation, why you are going through that cycle before you actually identify the problem, before you go through all that.
Is it a question or a statement? Sorry.
I just like to emphasize that.
Yes.
That's what I think is quite crucial to that person, that you're not making corrections because you think you're better. Mostly people are willing to accept your coaching if you explain to them that it's that you, what you have in mind really is to improve the process, improve the project, have the project done in time, improve the performance.
The observation is that if we can get across to the person, if we can explain to them why it is, what our motivation is in doing this,
before
starting to get into the problem, we are actually explaining why it is that we're trying to highlight this and get some improvement or get some change. So there's an element, in other words, a framework of goodwill applied to this that people want to see that happen. Yeah, good point. Thank you. Okay, let's move on. Let's do some more role play. Pair up, if you would, again. Same pairs or different pairs, just as you like. And here's a little role play to go through. One of you is the leader, one of you is the follower, or the subordinate, or the employee, or whatever. A has noted that in meetings, B keeps interrupting other people to put across their point of view. And it's starting to be a real problem with the other team members. So you as the leader of the group are conscious of this. And now you as A, you've asked for a meeting with B, and you want to try and tackle this problem. So do it for 5 minutes. To discuss this problem, and then swap over. Try it the other way about. Let's go on, folks. Let's pull this together. Let's have some reactions. Any comments? Any key learnings? How did it feel? All right? Yeah.
As well, taking suggesting that we do this together. we lead this together, the team meeting, let's give opportunities to others together. So that was pretty good.
Uh-huh.
That's a good approach.
Did he communicate to you that you were doing something which was that was unhelpful, or did he pretty much skate around that?
I think he communicated that I'm too helpful.
Too helpful.
That's a good
point.
All right.
Yeah. The only drawback might be that you might do even more of it in the future. I don't know.
That's what he encouraged. So he set a specific channel how to do that. He said, to do it over email, which, of course, would encourage me, in effect, to be even more active. However, not to do those meetings. So I think that was an excellent example of how to go about that.
Okay.
Thank you. Actually, he played very well. Because while I was talking, he started to talk. And actually, I was thinking to see if he really enjoys the meetings,
yeah,
or if he's just doing it for the sake of interrupting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, realizing that he's really part of it, I try to encourage him to other venues of expressing himself, not only in the meeting.
Good. The only. Let me just say, the one difficulty about finding clever ways to communicate something that we don't really feel all that terrific about communicating, the only difficulty with that approach is that the person winds up not actually understanding what the issue is at all. I mean, there are wonderful stories told about the boss who he finally decides he's going to fire this employee. He's just had it up to here with the employee, and he has the employee in, he sits down with him, and they spend half an hour together, and at the end of the meeting, the employee leaves the office with a big smile on his face, and somebody says to the boss, well, how did it go? He said, I did it, I fired him at last. I've actually done it. And somebody says to the employee, well, how did it go, your discussion with the boss? Yeah, it was a great discussion, you really helped me, it was a very motivational discussion, I really know what he wants me to do in the future. Unfortunately, both had a good discussion, but they didn't necessarily actually join in the middle. So, pleasantness and an acceptable way of doing it is important. Clarity is also pretty important. So don't sacrifice the one for the other, if I can put it that way. Any other observations?
On theirs?
Oh, no, on anybody's. On.
I think Henrik helped me understand that I was speaking more than he was.
Good.
I had a bigger contribution than him.
Yeah. It's that moment when you kind of go, aha, right. I'm catching on, yes.
Did you think that you were wrong?
If you can, very good. If you can enlist the person, as I think you two guys, if you can enlist the person in helping to improve the situation, so much better. So it's not just you telling him to do it, but you agreeing together that this is an improvement that needs to be done. That's a huge step.
Well, I'm just getting back to the example you were having about the lady coming in late in the morning.
Yes.
My first idea was to try the first action that I would take is make them responsible for reporting arrivals of other people in the morning. The first step probably always the first option to somehow make it positive. Give someone responsibility that's motivating in the direction that I want that to be. So that's especially useful in team meetings.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? Is that instead of just confronting that person clearly with what's going on and how I want that to be corrected,
I first try to invent a way that I inject some kind of motivation that would drive that person away from that behavior that I would like.
And I think that's fine.
The clarity comes to the game, and of course that is then resolution cycle. But you know, if you use some creativity in your leadership or management role, that helped me a lot in many instances. Mm-hmm. I had team meetings and I was managing teams.
Craig, you look as if you have a comment you want to make.
Well, I just thinking that this particular thing seems to be one that does bring an issue of the moderator or the leader of the meeting.
Yes.
And so if someone is causing a persistent problem of interrupting, then there is a platform for the leader to say, there's also something here I can do to help this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can help to think of how it's become so common now, what we call talk shows or even debates now, that people don't really discuss matters in a very orderly fashion anymore. You have three or four people talking at once. And of course it's chaos, but somehow it's become almost acceptable.
Yes.
And
that then creeps into our meetings.
Yeah, the moderator of these things, of course, is the one that really controls whether a sensible discussion actually occurs. People just keep interrupting each other.
Right. Certainly, the moderator has a clear role. But that's why sometimes it's necessary for the moderator, rather than necessarily trying to sort it out in the meeting room itself, it may just be too difficult to try to do there, because it would be embarrassing or awkward, or you just have, you say in the end, shut up, let somebody else get it. Rather than do that, you actually say, take them aside afterwards and actually say, look, it's starting to be disruptive or whatever. The only problem that I have with trying to find clever ways of doing it is, A, that it can be manipulative, and B, that it can fail to get the message across. So I'm not meaning to criticize. I'm just saying, be sure that you actually do get to where it is you want to go. It does. And, that's right, and delicacy.
One of the reasons why the two of us talked about, because he did pretty much the same, became very, very nice. I didn't feel threatened necessarily as a person when he dealt with the problem, is that, especially in our part of the world, if you try to be too direct, the other person won't take the issue at stake, but the person. And then say,
absolutely right. Yes.
And it's my person being under the attack, therefore I have to do something about it. And then rather than resolving the issue, there will be a fight between the two eventually. So
very true. I think that's a very good comment.
That was what both of us
thank you. Mm-hmm. That's a very helpful observation. Thank you, Adi. Yeah. Anything else? Anybody else's feedback on there?
Well,
in your discussion.
Not just a role play, but I realized how rare this is in Christian organizations and churches.
Yeah.
And that's actually a question of love.
Mm. It absolutely is.
Everybody is aware, well, this person always talks too much. Well, that's just him. That's we have to put up with it. Mm. But nobody loves him enough to help him find a solution to that.
Yeah.
And so the person maybe even... like that's what we had here, maybe aware of the problem himself.
Yeah.
So after every meeting, he feels, well, I talk too much again.
Yeah. Yeah.
But nobody loves him enough to help him find ways of dealing with it.
Yeah, I think that's a very acute comment. I can remember an occasion with a pastor, somebody that I was working with, he had a member of his pastoral team who'd had a nervous breakdown. He'd been off work for 6-9 months, and he'd come back to work slowly. And he was involved with a particular ministry in the church, and it just hadn't had much attention for a long time. And it was really this guy was coming back to work very slowly and doing bits and bits and bits. And this man who'd had the breakdown, he just didn't show up for some of the meetings. And in the end, this pastor friend of mine said to me, "Okay, well, I think it's time that he was looking for another job." So I said, "Well, that seems a bit extreme. Have you talked to him about the problem at all?" "No, but I think it's time that he moved on." Again, just in that situation, he'd come to the end of his patience, understandably. And maybe the other guy really was stringing things along. But maybe also he didn't understand that there was an increasing level of expectation that now he should be getting back into the work and taking a fair load. But nobody had stopped and explained that to him. As you say, it's the love question. Are we actually loving the person enough to do something about it? That's the question.
Yeah, in fact, in both of our scenarios, the person being accused, or that's too strong, but the confronted, took the position of being somewhat reluctant to admit it or saying, "That's just my personality. It's really their problem, they're weak, and I'm just a strong person." And
yes.
I jump in with answers. But in that situation, you eventually have to be strong with the person and say, "What's the problem? You have to fix it. We have to fix it together."
Yeah.
And in fact, that was when I thought more, "Well, actually, you know, I'm also leading the meeting, so I'm asking him to stop something, but I can also do something as the moderator, as the leader, to maybe make it easier for him."
Yes. Yeah.
So it became a two-way street then.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely.
My experience is that we very often just don't take in consideration those who are more shy, more reserved. You know, just by asking them, just challenging them to talk, we can already reduce the time of those who talk too much. So sometimes it can be done indirectly.
Yeah.
Because then very often we just,
just kind of let it go.
Yeah,
we don't grip on it. Yeah. I find that in teaching students, that there are some who will be very willing to talk and some who are much less willing to talk. And the ones who are willing to talk sometimes just squeeze out the others. They just never get any air time. With a student, it's not so hard to say, "Okay, now you just, let's not hear from you. Somebody else want to talk about this." You can do that with students. It's much harder to do in a business meeting or a staff meeting, which is why sometimes you have to take it offline if you're really having to tackle a problem. Anybody else?
Yeah, let's just kind of think about when we kind of discuss about why maybe we don't do often such kind of things, so coaching or feeding back. I think that takes out of ourselves out of the comfort zone. Because any issue what we can approach could make us also vulnerable in a one way that we don't take too personally that thing. Because often what we do, we take it personal. It's connected with our personalities. And then I think the natural way, just in one way, to ignore it and concentrating only on the task, on the job that we need to do. But we forget that we work with the people.
Yeah.
And through them, this task could be achieved.
Yeah.
And then that's what you said, the real leadership is not comfort zone leadership.
It's giving them what they need, yeah. Yes.
One question, is actually one slide back, I think, is that cycle?
Yes.
Yeah, would you need a procedure if you're identifying a problem with your superior, perhaps? That might be a very specific instance
of
this problem.
Yeah.
I'm just remembering one
slide. Yeah. The question is, how would you deal with this if it was a problem with your superior? As opposed to a supporter.
Something that's affecting your work,
yes.
Your assignment.
Yes.
And where in those stages, how far would you go?
Yeah.
Where would you stop?
It's a good question. How do you deal with a superior where there's a problem that you believe needs to be raised? To be To be honest, I think in some similar ways, but not in identical ways.
Yeah, that's
I would have said, and I try. It's to some extent a question of how secure do you feel, if I can put it that way. How secure do you feel? How confident do you feel in the relationship that the person will take a criticism, will take a comment from you? In my relationships, I have at least two bosses, one in England and one in Romania, and I actually, partly it's my grey hair helps, I feel quite comfortable about giving them feedback if I think that there's something that that I don't agree with. But I probably do it in a different way than I might do it for somebody who was working for me.
Is it more manipulative?
No. I try not to be manipulative, but it might be slightly less direct. It might be less direct. I would try not to be manipulative. I try to show my hands. I'm not trying to do something behind my back. I am trying to show my hand. But I do find that if I've got a problem with a boss, for instance, I'll go through those first parts of it. Depending on how I may or may not fix a meeting, I may just take it as something that I will do in a meeting, in another meeting, a business meeting, a one-to-one meeting, and I'll raise it with the person and say, I think this is a problem. Or if I think it's a sufficiently serious one, I will seek a meeting to talk about this particular thing. Where I felt that, some behavior was really inappropriate or something like that. I would tackle it. The great thing about it is that the bosses that I've had have been humble enough men to listen to it and take it on the chin. I've occasionally had a long argument about the point where the person's defended their position and where I've counter-argued. There are times when I've been wrong and I've backed off. But there are also times when I've been right and I haven't. So I think they find it helpful. So I would do it, but it does depend on the relationship of trust that you have with your boss. And how polite you are. Thanks for the question. It's a very interesting one. Let's wind this up, because I would like to just say that I think that this is servant leadership really at its best. You see, I think that that Jesus did this kind of leadership. I don't want to stretch the point too hard, but I think that if we think about Jesus and what he did, he met people's needs, he met his disciples' needs rather than their wants. I don't know if you have your Bible with you, but I will use mine, my handy one here, and I'll just give you those references. Matthew 11. Matthew 11 is, come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. He meets needs rather than wants. People don't want a yoke at all, but he gives them one that is easy and light. The instruction and feedback with Nicodemus is very straightforward and clear. He doesn't pull any punches with Nicodemus. If you remember, if you think about how he spoke to Nicodemus, he said things like, "You are Israel's teacher, and do you not understand these things? I tell you the truth, we speak of what we know and we testify to what we've seen, but still you do not accept our testimony." So he's very straight with people. And he corrects his followers, if you think of the reference in Mark 10, where he is speaking to the disciples in from verse 42, if you have it there. Jesus called, if you remember, John, James and John's mother had come and asked if they could sit at the right and left hand of Jesus. In Mark, they come themselves rather than their mother. When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John, and Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." So he is very clear in correcting them when they're wrong. And I think that Jesus, as the servant leader, is the model for us to follow in the same way. He didn't pussyfoot around. He didn't tell them just things they wanted to hear. He told them things that they needed to hear in order to grow. And I think that we will lead best if we do as Jesus did in serving our followers, serving the people that work with us and for us, if we're giving them this kind of straight and honest feedback. Henry.
John, I have a question. I just said yesterday, maybe it was today in the morning, an email debate with some colleagues, because I want to teach in the future a course called Servant Leadership. And one of our leaders, he studied business, so he comes from this area. And one argument was that in about 10 different organizational structures, maybe in two you can use the servant leadership style. Otherwise, you cannot do it. So, and I'm just wondering what would be your comments to this argument?
Yeah. Well, I'm interpreting servant leadership very much in the style of which I've been talking about it this afternoon. In other words, giving people what they need. Not giving people what they want, which is what people think servant leadership is. It's not just being nice to people. I hope that I will be nice to people, but I'm prepared to be tough with people if that's what it's needed, because that's ultimately how they grow. I don't believe that God simply is intending for us to be happy. He is intending for us to be holy. And so he doesn't simply do things that make us happy. He does things which are designed to make us holy. I think as leaders, that's our responsibility. And in doing that, we serve best. Just as Jesus said, he didn't come to be served, but to serve. In the same way, a boss or a superior or a manager is not there to be, or a pastor or a teacher or a lecturer, is not there to be served, but to serve. And I think this is the way we do it best.
And you would say
I think it applies in every organization and culture, because the thing we want to do in every organization is to cause people to grow, to go from R1 to R4 in this context, or to perform, or to deliver, or to produce high quality, or to behave in ways that are consistent with our mission. Point.
I think this doesn't have an absolute answer, but this kind of leadership would obviously take tremendous amount of time and effort and thought. So I'm thinking, in your experience, how many people can you sort of do this mentorship thing with at any one time? I mean, of course, like I said, there's no absolute answer. It depends if they are already R4 or they are R1.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just repeat the question. How many? It is time consuming and demanding to do this, to give this kind of leadership full time, and how many people can you do it with? To what extent is it doable? The answer is yes, absolutely. It is somewhat time consuming. It does take time. However, it's rare for anybody to have an organization that is purely composed of R1s. You usually got them spread across the spectrum. And it's really the R1s who take the time. That's why one of the reasons we want to move them from being R1 to being R4, because they will take less time under those circumstances, because we can let them get on with it, because they're doing it the way that we would want them to do it. So usually an organization is a mix of those. We do have to figure out what is our priority in our particular jobs, because we've all got a number of different priorities, and we'll have to have them in priority order. But I would suggest that leading people is probably high on that list of priorities for most of us. Shaping them, helping them to grow, helping them to develop, needs to be a pretty high priority. And so we'll probably give it the time that it needs, but it is time-consuming. I don't want to hide that. Nevertheless, I think it's probably the most worthwhile task that a leader can give. How many can you do at a time? Well, Jesus did 12, but then he was Jesus. It's hard to lead. Again, depending on the task. If it's a repetitive, routine task, then 12 or 15 is not impossible. If it's a pretty demanding task, set of tasks, where people cannot be just kind of left alone to get on with it because they're very early in their development stage, then relatively few. I don't think that you can cope with more than 3 or 4 R1s at a time. I was talking to Jelu a little bit earlier in the break about my wife, who took over the responsibility for cafeteria. She was the head cook, and she had to recruit they had 6 people. They fired 5 of them at the start because they were not doing things in the way that they should be done. So to really start with a clean sheet, she had to get rid of most of them and start again. So she had a bunch of people who came in. They had some experience, but unfortunately the attitudes weren't right. And so actually at the end of about 12 to 18 months, a number of them left, and she had to start again. This time she chose people on the basis of attitude and what she perceived as heart, without much experience. So they were all R1s. And she gave them quite a bit of time, like 10 hours a day, but they grew dramatically. And with the heart being right, it made all the difference to the task. And so the leadership applied in the right way. She is now actually able to step back and give responsibility in that area. And that's a year. So 5 R1s for a year can become... They're not our ones all the time. They grow remarkably. I've got a brief bibliography there. In a sense, the answer to your question there, Pauline, is in a way in the first one, the 1 Minute Manager. It's a very lightweight book, but it is... It's got some very worthwhile messages in it, and I would recommend reading it. The other two are both by Max Dupree. Leadership is an Art and Leadership Jazz. He's actually also written another one, which is more about leading without authority. In other words, somebody who's trying to lead a team of volunteers. So you might like to, if you're particularly having to deal with volunteers, I would recommend having a look at that. I have a great admiration for Max Dupree. as is evident by putting two of them on there. You could have a string of management or leadership books here. I've only given three favorites, and they're all easy reads and short, but I recommend them. And I think that about winds up everything that I have to say. I'm more than glad to take questions, debate, discussion for as long as you would like to. Well, until...
Question I have regarding to, in addition to Greenleaf, what kind of books are on this? Who picked it up? There is, of course, an Institute of Servant Leadership, which was started by Greenleaf. Is there some other, scholars which picked up this idea and work on this idea more?
The situational leadership?
On servant leadership.
On servant leadership. On servant leadership.
Yeah, like this classical book, today, I suppose it's kind of a 25 editions in publishing.
Yes. I haven't explored the literature on that, I have to admit. So I can't give you a specific answer, I'm afraid. I'm more of a practitioner than a researcher in this, and so I'm always glad to learn about resources that people might have. These are simple management books that I would recommend. Yeah. He was asking, is there wider literature available on this question of servant leadership? And he was mentioning Greenleaf, who's specialized in this area and written books with them. There's a book that it's gone into 18 or 19 editions, as you said, that
25.
25, as many as that. Yeah. So, which is sort of the work on it.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of other work in this area, but I'm quite sure there is a good deal of it. So I've been more at the practitioner end of it, as I say, than at the researcher end.
Robert Clinton of Fuller is also some books on this area.
Thank you. Anything else, folks? Well, before you go, I must go and grab Janice and ask her to just give you the survey forms. Excuse me a second.